Yeah, I'm ready.
So it's just a perfect bodyboarding line.
Didn't even jump off my board. I just tried to choke Jason Brown.
The windpipe is a big dream.
Hit the lift, you're going into the flats.
No, I know I could go bigger than that, and I know what I can do.
Hey, what's up? This is Manny Vargas, and we're going to open up volumes of stories of bodyboarders just like you. This is Boog Life.
Hey, what's up, gang? This is Manny V, and oh my goodness, I got to sit down with legendary bodyboarder Chris Tenberg, and well, disclosure right off the bat, I was a little high during this interview, all right? So I haven't smoked since my captain's license test. They did a drug test and everything, so, you know, I thought I would be able to hang. But obviously, I smoked a little bit too much. So right off the bat, I just had to get the show going. And if I got it going, then I thought I'd be okay. And that's what happened. So apologies if anything sounds or seems a little off. That is the reason. But the stories, holy crap, they are insane. Everything from the Kauai Classic regimen to, you know, the actual story on who found Chopes. It's all in here. Part one and part two are going to be, you know, staggered, one tonight and one in a week. So, man, I hope you enjoy it. I enjoyed every single second of it. I love that guy, and I hope you enjoy it just as much as I did. All right, this is Chris Tenberg, part one. All right, so what's up, everybody? This is Manny V, and welcome live here. Obviously, we're in Long Beach. You can hear the sirens outside. No, but we're with Chris Tenberg, a good friend, old school friend, and it was freaking awesome just catching up with him.
Amazing.
Before the interview, so we're going to get some more stories from him. Chris, thank you very much to you and your lady for letting us come into your...
Absolutely, I'm pitted right now.
Perfect.
Seriously, though, how long has it been since we've seen show? Let's try and figure this out. Like,
oh my gosh.
Because I know I was like, bro, I don't even know how long it's been, but like... When is your last memory of me? There we go. I'm flipping the script. Here we go.
No, No.
Come on.
Fuck. I feel like it's hard, right?
I'm old. I don't remember anymore.
I feel like I always have a freaking Kauai Classic story every other interview. just because you guys were ruthless.
Were we at the Schlitterbahn together ever?
Gosh, I'm not sure.
Because kind of in my mind, I feel like... That's my last memory of us being together, but I don't know. I mean, there's too much fog, you know.
I'm right there with you. I know for a fact. Who was in IB?
Oof. Okay. So in IB, now let's try and situate the year here. Are we talking 1990?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1990.
Yeah.
Year after I graduated high school.
Whoop.
so that would be, to my recollection, it would be the full crew. JB, Jason Brown, Harry, Auntie Paula, Kyle Maligro, myself. I want to say Douglas Marocca.
What?
Yep. It was either him or McConaughey Young was with us. Burkhart was obviously there, but Burkhart was already wave rebelling it.
What does that mean?
Oh, so Chris was part of the original six of the Kauai Classic team. So the original six were Harry, Auntie Paula, Chris Burkhart, Jason Brown, Kyle Maligro, myself, and Douglas Marocca. And then, so as we turned pro... and contract negotiations started out.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So there was a kind of principle that our coach operated by that was like, I would say like the one true principle that he operated by business-wise for us was, you like the Kauai Classic team? All or nothing. Like for real, like to sponsor. It was kind of something that helped us and hurt us in hindsight, looking back. So, but one of the problems was is that... In the very beginning, you know, as you know, getting sponsors, it's not like you get a fucking sweet deal right out of the gates, you know? It's like maybe you get to an incentive and product deal or something like that back in the day.
Yeah.
And there were six of us. And like, who's going to take on six guys, right? So, like, I think Bob in his, and that's Bob Sato, by the way. Rest in peace, brother. Love you. My former coach and mentor. What a great and complex dude. Anyway, so in his business principles, though, in the early days, even it was like, nah, our sponsorship's going to be all or nothing. And one of the first like separations of the original six came when Wave Rebel made an offer to Chris Burkhart via Burkhart's strong Oahu connections with, you know, Kainoa and Jackie Booter and all them, Eli Tanganen and stuff. Remember that guy? Because Burkhart, although a solid Kauai boy from the start, he also went to Kamehameha. And so he spent a lot of time on Oahu at Sandy's, you know, with all the boys, you know. So I think it was through that and them connection that Wave Rebel made Chris an offer, and it was good. It was great. And Bob didn't like that.
Ooh.
And turned it into a, well, take the deal or the team.
Oh.
And you know, to his fucking credit, Burks took the deal. And so that was the first, like, separation of the original six.
Yeah. Wow. How did everybody take to that? Was there any...
Let's get things straight. I was 18. And now as I'm, you know... older. You're still younger than you, though, Manny, right? Or damn, did it. We figure that out?
Yeah. Just December 3rd.
Yeah. Ooh. So anyway, I was 18, and at the time, I was sad that I wouldn't be living and traveling with Chris anymore. But besides that, I didn't really put all the pieces together. Like, I was really young at the time. I'm not going to use that excuse all the time, but like, I was just stoked that I was hanging out with my friends and getting free gear and whatnot. And my coach was making pancakes for me in the morning and filming me. I was like, yeah. Oh. So yeah, it was a bummer that Chris wasn't going to be like kind of moving in our crew, but I didn't have any, you know, rivalries or anything. I think I won't name names. I think maybe a couple people in the group, in the Kauai Classic group, took it as a kind of, you know, bummer move.
Oh.
I don't want to use the word betrayal because that's way too strong.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a bummer move. But, you know, nah.
Okay.
Nah.
Yeah. All right.
Hey, thanks for having me on, by the way. This is great. Yeah.
No, that's so.
JG. Good to see you, by the way. Long time.
Thanks, JG, for coming to help again.
Hey, what was the original question, right? But when were we in IB? Was that it?
Yes.
When was the last memory we have?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Let's just say that to this day, like, you're referred to in my stories as, like, the mayor of Imperial Beach in my mind.
What?
Yeah, yeah. Insofar as, like, you and the crew were, like, they were my points of contact down there. So, like, I didn't know anybody. If somebody, like, said something to me, I'd be like, nah, yeah, I'm with those guys. You know what I mean? But that kind of thing. So,
you know who just became city council?
Who? Not somebody from the old...
Jaggy Fisher.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, actually city council?
He just got...
Wow.
How many city council do we have?
Three and mayor.
So there's three city council and one mayor.
So I heard that your guys' water issue is shittier than ever down there.
It's freaking crazy. The development on the other side,
yeah,
and that much more water in that valley, the way it comes out, it's gnarly.
Wow.
They're supposedly like this $3 billion plan.
Yes, there's $3 billion.
Yes. I mean, is it like
to
so
fix that?
There's a couple spots on Kauai still where locals know, like, bro, you have an open cut, don't fucking surf over there.
Yeah.
Okay, is that still strong in IB?
Only really after storms.
So, yeah, same for us.
Yeah,
really.
Okay,
because they just flagrantly throw it over the wall like in hoses.
Wow, yeah, that's
pretty gnarly.
Nuts.
But I mean, the development wasn't super, it wasn't so crazy as it is now. It was so much less people in that area. But we all went bodyboarding before, during, and after a rainstorm.
Oh,
Oh, yeah. Well, same here.
Yeah.
You know who always got sick, too?
Oh, no.
Burkhardt always got sick. I don't know why, Rob. Every time that Hawaiian gets cut, if he goes in dirty water, he's clipped.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Good times, though. I'm very happy. I'm in Long Beach right now. My girlfriend Jessica and I have been living here for a year. But I'm very happy to announce that I'll be moving back home permanently in March. And in the group chat, for the purposes of the interview, this is an old school group chat between Harry, Jason, Kyle, Burkhardt, and myself. It's good fun. We're all looking forward to being back home at this chapter in our life, you know?
Epic.
And just relaxing, hanging out.
How much would it take to be able to get access to that group chat?
So I'm cool with it because I just say
what these guys are talking about, because the guys that I know, I kind of have a feeling what it would look like.
Yeah. You have to have a strong constitution. Like if you can handle cock and balls, you know, you'll be okay. You know, it's pretty good.
So how much?
How much? Yeah, I'll just give it to you. Actually, you take me on that Indo trip, I'll get you free access right there. I'm breaking the boy code, boys, for surf.
Oh, okay.
Some of the best stuff on there is Harry's pre-sexual diet routine.
Oh. But
that's all. I'm not saying anything more than that.
All right. So I'm going to try to make that happen. We got Ben Severson. I really wanted somebody else to be there that he would connect with. And I think that would be awesome.
Okay, this is great, because I'll just dive right into this now.
Okay, go.
You're saying that Ben is going to go on the Indo trip.
Yes.
Okay. So as I mentioned as we were driving around here, I have one little sort of mystery story from the industry that I'd like to clear up here.
Boom.
And it actually involves Ben Severson.
Oh, is it good or bad?
Oh, it's both.
Ooh.
It's both. It's okay. Both. It's got everything. It's got romance. It's a good one. So it involves Ben Severson and I going on a surf trip. All right. And
to where?
With Mike Stewart. Okay. And I'm going to call this story in my own sort of way. I'm going to call it the Chopu debacle. Okay. And so here's the deal. Somewhere between 1990 and 1992... I guess 2 years, right? We're so high right now. Somewhere between 1990 and 92. Okay, I only know because I don't fucking have the exact dates in my hair. But okay, somewhere around there, the year-end rankings happened to be where Mike was first, Ben was second, and I was third. Okay. And
shit.
Yeah, like, ooh, yeah. Anyway. There also was like the top three surfers for the PSA. And what happened was the Tahitian Surfing Federation said something about like, oh, they're going to take the top three bodyboards, the top three surfers, fly them to Tahiti. And, you know, we're going to do this exhibition contest, promo event, blah, 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 blah. You know, Ted Robinson went, Pat O'Connell and Machado. Right. And Mike Balzer was there. Remember him, the photographer, right? And Mike, Ben, and myself went. Now, pictures. I'm either 19 or 20, depending on the 2 years. Okay, put this in full perspective here.
Whoa.
Okay, and so the PSA says at the end of the year, they just spring it on us. The first problem was that I had to convince Bob Sato that I should go by myself. Without the crew, because remember, it's the all or nothing principle, which played in a big role there, too. Anyway, that's not the interesting part of the story. I wiggled out of that one.
Yes, it is. What happened?
Well, I think it was like regarded as a good promotional event for the Kauai Classic team. And I would be like the figurehead for the team.
Genius.
Going. Yeah, that's how he put it out there. And so. Because they weren't going to buy fucking six tickets down there, or it was four at the time. So anyway, I'm like stoked. This is my first like out of the country surf trip, like legit.
Sick.
Yeah. Even before Mex, by the way. And so we fly in there. We go to Moorea for a couple like days, photo shoots, blah, blah, blah. Get to the main island. And what's going to happen on the main island?
Wait a second. What was it like landing there? you're landing to this whole new island that doesn't speak your language. It's totally freaking.
It's all French and expensive.
Yeah.
It was kind of surreal too because I got along really good with Ben at the time. Ben was much less intense than Mike.
What does that mean?
Back in the old days, bro, Mike was fucking intense, bro. That guy's a personality. He probably still is. I just haven't seen him in years. And, you know, Ben had come to Kauai a couple of times and stayed at the house and, you know, got along great with Bob and with Chris Ann and everything. So I'd hung out with Ben before. So first of all, traveling with those guys and like I knew Pat O'Connell pretty good because of the Salt Creek days. Right. Because he was with Scotty Carter and Curtis Pan and Olson and all that. So it was good. Was cruising. Ted Robinson was my body glove team manager.
Damn.
So I felt pretty good. Anyway, we get there and so we're on the main island now and there's going to be like an exit.
What did the other team riders feel?
That's a mixed question. You might have to ask them. I think they're pretty sour now. Oh. Now it's like a sour happy. So like we were always stoked for each other. I think genuinely like always stoked for each other.
Yeah.
But there was probably, you know, moments for all of us where it was a little competitive still.
Yeah. It has to be.
And I was a weird guy on tour. Like, so here's the thing. I was quick digression. We'll get back to the other thing. We got time, right?
Yeah. We got 36 hours.
It's a relevant digression. Like, so how the fuck did I get to third place in the rankings? Let's explain that first.
Okay.
Okay. So first of all, would it surprise you to know that amateur career and pro career combined, I have only won 2 contests ever in my life.
That's all you needed.
Well, no, the thing
even
is, like,
one was hard.
I'm not the guy that wins contests or invents maneuvers. you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not the guy that people are waiting to see, like, oh, what's he gonna fucking do? I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. Smooth meat and potato surfing, like, or, you know, body worn. The point is, that's just what I got into. That's what my skill level was at. And so I was fairly consistent. And so I wouldn't get first, but I'd always be like top 7, you know, in the finishes. And then at the end of the year, oh shit, sometimes that's good enough.
Yeah.
You know, whereas both Jason, Harry and Kyle, if you think about them, those are the guys that would win like 3 contests, but then place like 33rd in the other 4 because it's like super big or not make the super big.
Yeah.
Like they'll pull the big move or not pull the big move. Whereas I'm just doing like, yeah, the meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you got it done consistently.
So that's how I got to 3rd. Right. In the rankings that 1 year. And
okay.
So maybe some people on the team, I'm speculating, I never got a vibe from it, but maybe some of them thought like, you know, I should be the one going with Mike and Ben because Mike and Ben were Mike and Ben in those days. And let's talk about bodyboarding royalty, right?
Okay.
Bro. So like I was fresh out of high school, even by that time, you know, and those are the guys I had on my wall. Yeah.
Still are.
I mean, Stuart was smooth as butter, dude. I mean, watching that guy, I tried to pattern my prone style as a mix between Mike and Ben. I think Mike is more elegant looking for me. Back in the day, I'll be critical right now. I think his smooth days are beyond him. But, I mean, charges, but he's not as smooth anymore. He's fucking old, dude. I mean, we're all old now.
Yeah.
But God, that guy that was the god of style and smooth for prone for me. And then actually, I learned more about barrel riding from Ben. And I prefer his barrel riding technique to Mike's. I think Mike's a pumper. And what I want to say is I think Mike's, oh shit. Whoa.
Hello.
I think Mike's a pumper. You know, like he fucking pumps that barrel. And, in the early days, at least Ben was more like a fucking rail rider. And he would draw a line on his rail and just figure out the right spot to be and just hold it. And maybe that was a factor of his stature. I don't know. But
no.
I eventually got to enjoy that style more than the fucking, you know, the swiveling and moving all kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you see it on the bottom turn. As soon as he engages that rail, boom, he's
in.
He's found the perfect line.
Right. And I got, so I really had, so my, I think my stylistic stuff was I tried to, Mike, I really liked the way he bodyboarded and then but I preferred Ben's lines, I think, yeah, a lot. And oh, and Ben's cutbacks. Oh, God. Ben's cutbacks were better for sure.
Describe it. Describe it, what he was doing.
So Ben, so for me, for Ben, the way he would do a really good cutback is he would somehow have a really high line on the wave and then use the high line power to just go rah, almost like when you see John or someone, you know, like just go up with a slow bottom turn and then just use the real top part of the wave to just go and just dig it down.
Yeah.
And since he is the troll, he had this method of like shifting his weight way farther back, you know, and so really putting his you know, into that gut, and he'd always get a really nice fan. And I aesthetically, I always liked the sprays, you know. And so I was like, oh, well done, sir, well done. Yes.
How long did it take you to learn that?
Foof, I didn't tell you about bodyboarding. So first of all, I wasn't a bodyboarder at first. I brought this up during Harry's thing a little bit, but yeah. Growing up in on Kauai, kind of like my, I would say my junior high, like surfing, no, like just before junior high and junior high, like surfing people that I looked up to were Harry and local guys in the community. This guy named Ruben Balmoris, Makani McDonald, Aaron Sentez, my good friend Miguel Graham, but they're all surfers, and I was surfing too. And even as we entered high school, Harry's a couple years older than me.
Wait, you started surfing? Did you even bodyboard? Or
very early we were bodyboarding, but it was more just charging shore break. At so I'm not okay if we count that. Yeah, this is pre-junior high then.
Okay.
But this is just like going to the local shore break spot called Brenneke's and just pulling into barrels. And I remember Harry was like standing up and pulling into barrels. And we're like, yeah. But then it moved to surfing. And through junior high and into my early years in high school, even freshman year in high school, I'd say, I was still surfing. And then Harry busted out his knee. Harry was a senior in high school and busted out his knee. And he couldn't surf anymore.
What'd he do?
He was doing like a frontside air. So these were back in the days of like Matt Archibald,
yeah,
you know, young Archie,
Christian Fletcher,
yeah, and just trying airs and not being so. We didn't know anything, right? And he just fucking.
How'd he land?
I don't remember the details, but it basically busted out his knee, and his knee's still a problem now. He can surf now, but he's very tender with it too.
But before that, he was like pulling that shit.
I honestly think he was on track for a semi pro or pro career.
No way.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He was going.
Holy shit. Going.
So do you know Kaipo Hakias? He was like a Sonny Garcia era guy from Kauai, my classmate, you know, he did a good triple crown winner. You know, back in the 90s and stuff. And, you know, Harry was a couple years older than he and I, Kaipo and I. But, like, I think Harry would have had a real good, at least semi-pro career, if not full on.
Damn.
Yeah. But, no, but then, so as physical therapy, he switched to bodyboarding.
With the expectations to get back to surfing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Totally.
This was physical?
This is my recollection.
Okay.
I forget what he says, but anyway. I've always been kind of a Grom follower, you know, to those guys. It's back in those days, you know, sometimes I was, I felt like the real youngin', you know, and I would just kind of cruise along. Now I'm stoked I'm the youngest. But so Harry started bodyboarding, so I started bodyboarding. Simple as that. He was my ride to school. I'd smoke weed in the back of his car. First times I ditched school.
No way.
To go surf.
Yeah. How old were you? What age? High school?
Freshman, sophomore.
Shit.
Yeah. Not Waimea High School, where I remember for real that as a young white boy who grew up on Kauai, born and raised, had a Hawaiian stepdad, so that kind of offset some things too. I remember at Waimea High School playing when it was raining. You were real bummed when you had to go to PE because fucking Mr. Pereira was the PE coach and the football coach. And the activity for rainy days was tackle basketball. What? Yeah, and the mantra was always, throw the ball to the haoles. Because no, yeah, no, if you got the ball, you could be tackled, right? So I just remember like fucking dodging shit.
Holy shit. Yeah.
But it was good. I won't tarnish too much of Harry's past because he's a good boy now. But, you know, Harry was great because, you know, he was a great surfer and waterman already. He had all the hot chicks with him. You know, he was the banging guy who was a couple years older, man. He had the drugs. Yeah. It was fun.
Damn.
It was good. So he started surfing. Bodyboarding. I started bodyboarding. Harry started getting really good because I just think he's good.
Yeah.
You know, like legs and whatnot. So at the same time, like Kyle Maligro and Jason Brown and Chris Burkhart were always, I think, bodyboarders. I mean, they can all surf.
Yeah.
But they didn't really have that same path. They were doing good, right? Like Kyle's was a bodyboarder. We met Kyle in high school. He moved over, I think, when we were sophomores, and he was bodyboarding already.
Okay.
But Harry got good. And then I think he just decided to stick with it. And then Bob started organizing us, and that was it.
So how did you guys get approached? Like what made him approach you guys?
So Bob Sato was a real cool community figure. For all of his demons, Bob Sato was a really cool community figure on Kauai. He would show up at the popular spots almost religiously anytime the waves were good or he knew kids were down there, and he'd set up video, and as you were going out, he was Uncle Bob, and you'd be like, Bob, how's the waves? You know, he'd talk to you. He'd tell you, oh, yeah, you know, it's good over here, blah, blah, blah. You know, how are you doing? You know, how's things with you? He's a really solid guy. And as a young man, it was good. Oh, I might get emotional.
Yeah, no, all good.
No, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were all stoked, you know, everybody. We had the opportunity, you know, to hang out and see him do his thing. And he never, you know, you ask him a question, he had the answer. You know,
he was an intense fucker. But yeah. See, he also had two kind of personalities. So he had a public persona that was very ambassador-like.
That's what we know.
Yeah, totally. So when he's at the beach, he was like, hi to everybody. Like, you know, always doing good things, taking videos. And the video thing was always good for him because he was very early on in that respect, especially on Kauai. And he would invite kids, right, come watch, you know, come back to the house. He was a foster parent even before he got together with us. And so he was very community involved in that way. And I think, I'm not sure, to be honest, what it was, but let's just call it maybe the eye of like a talent scout of some sort. And for some reason, he kind of saw that the sport of professional bodyboarding was emerging very early. It had like a royalty, you know, Mike and Ben, plus I would say the four honorable mentions would be like JP, Pat Caldwell, you know, Jack, maybe Jay Real, you know, Dave Kniff. I'm probably missing people, but you get it. And there was time for a new guard. And maybe he saw what we didn't see. We were all just fucking, yeah, woo, 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 woo. And maybe he saw something and wanted to organize it. And literally, I was in high school. I was in my senior year. I remember, like, I was down at the beach and, like, Bob said, what, Chris, Harry guys talked to you yet? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. He's like, you should think about it. Just think about it. I remember saying, I was really, just think about it, yeah? I'm like, okay, go outside. And then there just was this talk of like, hey, you know, we should all fucking move in together and train. And you know.
Wait, what made you not give him an answer?
I didn't even know what it was yet. Like, I was headed out into the water. Like, it was one of those times, you know, like, and nobody had talked to me yet.
Oh,
yeah, sorry.
They were supposed to.
They were supposed to yet. And he goes, Harry, guys had talked to you yet. You know, like, did they talk to you yet? And I was like, nah, no, I don't know.
When, okay.
You know. And, you know, I don't know I don't remember the exact details, but eventually the plan had been hatched. You know, Harry and I believe Jason had already moved into Bob's house.
Whoa.
Yeah, so Bob had a really cool house, a very cool house. It was very, like, it was very team-oriented, man. Oh, this is good fun to talk about.
Yeah.
Basically, he had a garage, and then the upstairs of the garage had three rooms. And it was two guys per room. So Harry and Jason were in one room. Burkhart and Kyle were in one room. And Douglas Morocco and I were going to be in the other room. So Douglas Morocco was a local guy from Kaloa, same town as me. We were still in high school.
What?
Yeah, and all those other guys had graduated. So maybe that's why the plan came to us late.
Okay.
So the plan was pretty clearly laid out. We were all going to move in together and train, and kind of Bob had this idea about kind of, you know, forming a team, a Kauai team to, you know, tackle the bodyboarding scene. And so we're like, okay. And it seemed like the first stab was going to be Sandy Beach. You know, Sandy Beach was Sandy Beach back in the day, and the Gotcha Pro was coming up and blah, blah, blah.
They had it at Half Point, right?
Half Point, yeah. And we had from amateur contests, we knew Kai and Kaino McGee and all the boys. Oh, God, it was so much fun back in the day, the amateur days. Oh, my God. The amateur struggles at Half Point and Ala Moana and all. Seamus Mercado and all those guys. They're such a tight-knit group back then. Yeah. Oh, he was intimidating, too. I was young. Anyway, so we trained. We moved in and trained. Actually, I didn't move in yet because I was still in high school. And I was living at home. And eventually, Kyle won the Gotcha Pro. And that was like further confirmation to Bob that God was putting him in the right direction. Okay, so the religion aspect comes into there. Whoever, anybody knows the Nailed Kauai it. Classic thing, that's where the religion aspect became a really important, like I don't want to say it was the start of that because the religious thing was always in the background, but that was like a definite, we're on God's right plan here, you know?
Yeah.
And so then it just started to get more organized. Training regiments like every day.
What was the regiment like?
Right, we were up early.
Give us a full day, one day.
Standard day was up early, like 5:30 for calisthenics out on the front fucking lawn.
Wow.
Literally. Involving jumping jacks, stretching, and then right from there, right into like a 3-mile run.
No way. How old were you?
I started when I was 17.
So you're right.
So I graduated high school in June of 89, and my birthday is September 10th. So I didn't turn 18 until September, right? Mm. But I moved into Bob's place the day after I graduated.
Oh.
Yeah, which was walking distance from my mom's house.
You're like, but go ahead.
But it really is a different house. I mean, but it was a couple blocks down the street. I mean, Harry's place was walking distance from my house, too. So Harry's mom's place.
But it wasn't your...
It wasn't my house.
Yeah.
I moved out.
Yeah.
So then we fucking ran Pu'u Road. That was a thing. Right from Bob's place in Kalaheo, right around Pu'u Road.
This is before getting in the water?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And let me tell you, in the early days, even though we were a team, the competition between us was fierce.
Wait. Between who? Within the crew?
Yeah. Like, I'm talking like, who's making it around Pu'u Road first, you know?
Oh, so you're running.
We're running, right?
Like, you're competing against everything.
It was a very competitive, like, everything. Situation. Like, we were, right from the start, we knew that Bob had formulated this idea of we're going to approach the pro bodyboarding world as a unit, but within the unit, there was heavy, like, fucking competitiveness between all of us.
Holy shit.
Yeah. The funny one is Jason, I'll always refer to as the fucking lightning bolt, meaning JB will put out more, but it's only going to last a little bit of time. In other words, Rob, if you're going to try and go against JB on a paddle or a run, if it's, you know, anything less than, you know, half a mile, well, that's going to be hard to beat. But if it has been anything longer than that, he gets tired. So he's out. Harry's a good mix of the both. I was more sort of even keel. Like, I just tried to keep up, again, my kind of Grom follower thing. I was like, oh, who's the fucking fastest? I don't want to be the slowest, but I don't know if I can be the fastest. So I'm going to be like right in the middle again.
Like you've always done.
Right. It really characterized a lot of my surfing. You know, like,
wow.
I just kind of figured that out in my later years, you know.
Wow.
Thinking about that. It's trippy. So, yeah. So we'd run. When we got back, fresh pancakes. And fucking
who cooked it?
Bob, bro. Every goddamn morning. Holy, you know how he'd wake us up every morning? He would wake, we'd be sleeping, and he would wake us up. I remember this. He would wake us up, and he would walk over to the bed, and he'd fucking shake our toe like this. Wake us up, and then we'd go downstairs. But we'd come back from the run and have pancakes. And, you know, carbs, some sort of carbs and shit. And then we'd load up the gear and jump in the Scout. And he had this huge, like, 8-passenger, you know, international Scout.
That thing was sick.
Sick, yeah. He had a couple of them. But
was it orange?
That was, you saw one of the later ones. This one was an early one. I think it was, like, tan or something. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, that type of car. Maybe it wasn't actually the Scout. He was a fan of the Scout. But we'd load the stuff up in the gear. I would sleep every time, like, driving out there, because we would leave from our house and we'd either head west or north. Actually, west, north, or south. Is this boring?
Okay. No, this is good.
So the west side and the north side drives for us was fucking long, dude. So, like,
where were you based?
Kalahale, so that would be southwest.
Okay.
So to the South Shore, which was kind of our home spots, we're talking 10 minutes maybe. To the west side or the north, you know, you're looking at 45, you know.
Damn.
Yeah, so I would honestly, after the run and the pancakes, you know, I was known in the group for being able to sleep anywhere.
Yes.
And that's still to this day. Like, I can sleep on an inner island flight, bro. Just give me 3 deep breaths and I'm out. So I would always just sleep and wake up where we're surfing, which was wonderful. The few times that I didn't sleep, the usual routine would be like a series of stop and checks. Everyone knows this, right?
Yeah.
Right. And then, well, it's good here, but
might be better.
What do you think over there? Yeah. And then, so I was so stoked to, like, just be woken up where, okay, we're right. Perfect. We're here. So if we went west or north, it was pure surf. If we went south, though, the cross training didn't stop. Here's why. The south was just our home spot. So, like, yeah, fucking home spot. You can't just surf. So we would literally have a swimming routine attached to every time we went south. And the swimming routine was pretty rigorous. It was no fins, you know, swimming. I don't know the distance, because it was just, like, out to the point and back kind, you know. And then, and this is the part that Jason hated the most, it was mandatory 2-hour session.
Holy shit. No matter what.
No matter what.
Whether it's good or bad.
Crappy or not. And it was sometimes, Manny, miserable. Like, in the early days, didn't it puzzle you sometimes? And Bob would say, like, okay, boys, get out there. And, like, we would be forced to go out to the shittiest Bolsa Chica or ever. Just fucking out there, because no matter, for especially on contest times, was like, yo, out there, get out there. So JB always had JB was always, he says he's the lightning bolt guy, and I know everyone will back me up on this.
He's going in hard really quick.
And then, bro, he wants to tap out. The biggest joke is this, and this is true: if we all show up at the beach together, Jason will be first in the water. But Jason will be out of the water before Chris Burkhart finishes stretching. That's how it goes. And then once Chris gets in the water, he'll be out there for 4 hours, dude. Yeah, like just raw, yeah. You know. And that's pretty funny.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So Jason would have to wait.
Oh, it was. So if the big thing too with our group is that, you know, the rules and principles were to be obeyed. Now, I'll deal with kind of the, oh, this is all a digression from the Chopu thing.
We'll get there.
How much time do we have?
34 hours.
Okay, so the I just forgot what I said. Because I want to get back to that Chopu story.
And in your the workout and the water and Jason, and then we were at Jason.
Yeah.
Intense Jason was lightning bolt.
Yeah. Jason was always like, oh, the hot seat. That's where I was going. The rules were to be obeyed. And the thing was, and that came from our religious background. So why was Kwai Classic so religious? I'll give you the short story. In very formative years of our life, I was 17. A fairly slick new youth pastor rolled into town that was like no other. He was the kind of guy that didn't say anything about Jesus until he had taken you surfing and bought you lunch like at least 10 times. You know what I'm saying? Like he's very friendly, very cool guy. And, you know, then he slipped us the Jesus pill. And I'm not going to blame it on him. I made my own choices. But the point is, we all bit the pill really hard. And our coach was religious in that same regard and regarded us as kind of a missionary unit. That's a good 30-second way of doing it. And I was all in at the time, you know.
Knowing that?
Half.
What was your religious belief before that?
My dad was, agnostic, atheist. And at the time, my mom was newly religious, but religious because I had become religious. Like, she was interested in the moral reform because, you know, we were partying and smoking weed and doing all the things that normal teenagers do. And then youth pastor came into town and, oh, my God, this looks pretty good. Especially, you know, I mean, Harry Antipola's reform was completely a product of Bob Sato and the religious influence from the youth pastor and the movement that we got caught up in. It was a Jesus movement kind of thing. Did I know all about it and all the religious stuff? And did I know how obnoxious we were? yes and no. I mean, I knew that people didn't like us because we were religious. And what we were told is that, now that's part of the deal. Like, if you're really religious and sincere about it, people are not going to like you because you're doing God's work. You know? Whatever. I'm not a Christian anymore. I don't harbor any ill will towards people who are Christians. It's not a philosophy for me anymore. I outgrew it. And I love people. I think kindness and generosity and peace are virtues that and humility that I like to emulate. And whatever religion or ideology embodies that, I'm fucking on board.
Epic.
Yeah. But in the young years, religion was a big deal, and you didn't fuck with the order, the principles or the rules of religion. So when Bob had rules, they were kind of seen as training rules, but because we were kind of like a religious group, we were like a God-infused sports team. Commandments. And and so because of that, you know, Bob was kind of our mentor and our guide, and he was to be, you know, not obeyed is the wrong. You didn't want to cross him. And anyway, so if you did, you would be put in what's known as the hot seat. The hot seat is where literally you would sit in a particular seat in the living room, and the whole group would sit in and as a discussion, and basically you would be questioned about said behavior or event.
We heard about that.
Yeah. Like one of my favorite stories. One of my favorite stories of the early hot seat years, which is a funny one.
Wait, who was in the hot seat?
Chris Burkhart and Douglas Moroka. We all worked together at a restaurant in Poipu called Plantation Gardens. And, let's just say that when you're in your young when you're 19 and 20 and you're working in the service industry, let's just say that some honeys wanted to hang out. And girls were a no-no for the team because, you know.
Wait, what?
As religion goes, you don't want to be fornicating, right? And as training goes, girls were a distraction. Big time distraction in Bob's mind. No girls, they're too much of a distraction. So anyway.
Did you know that going in?
Yeah. Right, try look. Nobody was dating in the first 3 years of our thing, of our.
Yeah, he's right. No one dated. Any females.
No chicks at the contest ever.
Oh my God.
That was really strict.
And everybody rolled with females back in the day.
So Chris Burkhart and Doug Moroka don't come home one night. I came home from work. We all work at the same fucking place, right? They don't come home one night. They come home like in the morning, like, and Bob's up and we're all up. And let's just say it was hilarious, but they were doing yard work for like a week. It was good. So it was that kind of thing, you know. And
did you ever ask them if it was worth it?
Oh, it was totally worth it. Burkhart and I have had lots of like reminiscings about those days and how cab it was, how wacky and cabbage it was. Good times, but so cab, man. So cab. Yeah. So, yeah.
Damn. All right. You know what?
So Chopu.
Wait.
Oh, I got to go.
Okay, hold it. I would just want to give a shout out to.
Oh, yeah.
We got a few people watching. Opie and Big Todd. Can you guys hear us okay? Give me a thumbs up in the chat.
Boop.
And somebody has a question here.
Yeah, go for it. Let's interact with the folks.
All right. So this was a good question. It is from Big Todd. And his question is, Kauai Classic team tactics during the heats, Bud Tour days.
Yeah, that's
beautiful. So, thank you, Big Todd.
Yeah. I mean, of course, I kind of knew a question like that was going to come up because even back in the day, that was like what everyone wanted to talk to us about whenever there was an interview or something. So the basic idea was this. I have to say this was probably the product of Bob Sato. Like, no shit. He used to read stuff like The Art of War. And he was a shrewd strategist, that guy. A shrewd strategist.
Did you guys know it was going to get to that level signing up?
Nah, I had no idea.
Because that is like something that was, I don't even know, were they the first ones to do it?
It personified bodyboarding in that way.
There's this whole system that was in play and it was running smoothly.
These fucking motherfuckers
from Kauai come in and start disrupting everything.
Right, because it was an individualistic sport.
It was amazing. I freaking loved it. I was pissed.
I don't think the disruption. I think it was like what he's saying, the tactic, which was who's going to advance. If one or more of us are in that heat, who's going to push?
So watch me pull this all in philosophically. Remember, like earlier I said, like a really big principle for Bud was, I'm Bud. For Bud's my dog. And Bob was my coach. For Bob was all or nothing. Okay, but one way to feel about that is, hey, if one, then all. In other words, maybe we can't get everybody to the top, but if we can get at least one of us or two of us to the top, we're still in the top. And so basically the strategy was a kind of sacrificial strategy based on the given conditions. In other words, and it became more detailed as things went along. At first it was as simple as this. And the first victims were Mike and Ben, 100% by design.
Yes.
By design. And one of the best moments ever in my early competitive moments was when I remember that it was Harry and Jason sitting on Mike. And in one of the first things, like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to fucking sit on them. And so what that means, I'm assuming everybody knows, but what that meant was, you know, there's three people in the lineup. And no matter what, Mike was going to be in the middle. Okay. Like, who cares if we push ourselves way out of position? we don't give a shit. Like, one person is going to get the inside.
So back, like, yeah, that was it. JG just mentioned that back then there was no priority.
Oh yeah, zero priority. So it was all inside.
Outside gets the way.
Yeah,
it's hard. I don't know if it's hard for people to understand.
That's old school. That's right.
But man, there was no buzzer or system in place to say, okay, yellow had the last wave, right. So he's going to go fourth, and in red, you're next.
Here too, right? Gosh, I'm sorry about that.
Oh no.
Sitting on the inside wasn't safe. That was the fire zone, especially with Stuart. He was going to power paddle you.
And Stuart's such a good paddler.
Take nothing and show that he's on the wave and showing position.
So the other sports equivalent would be like double teaming someone in basketball. We basically double teamed him. And the way it would work is, is it a point break? No problem. Again, one guy's going to have the inside. We're going to force Mike in the middle, and I'll explain what happens afterwards. And then one guy's going to be on the shoulder. And what? Is it a peak? Even better. One guy's going to be on this side. One guy's going to be on this side. And Mike's going to be in the middle. And basically, it was a game of getting priority by means of having the inside. If we were on a point break, again, we could push somebody. We could push Mike so far deep that even, okay, here's a good example. So suppose it's a point break and Harry would just get the inside and that would drive Mike crazy because now I'd be sandwiched in between two people. So suppose a set comes in and Harry's too deep and he can't make the wave. Who cares? He's going to take off on it long enough so that Mike's out of position, cut out, and let JB take the rest of the wave.
Oh my God.
Right? Or if it's a peak and Mike thinks he's got the inside either way, nah, no ways. Because if he's on the peak and he wants to go left, fucking guy on the right will just go back door. He'll have to pull out to bail interference and then, you know, guy on shoulder goes.
I've seen you guys take Mike all the way down in a contest. Yeah. Literally,
it drove him nuts in the beginning.
Guys, and I think after a while, he just thought this is how it's got to work, and he would use his power. So he would run with you guys down the thing and then just gun it super fast back and power paddle away from you.
Chasing
him down because he's already gunned it back to the peak now. And if all of you were in his heat, that was terrible. But I mean, he gunned it back and get as much as he could before you guys came back. And then he would just do that same thing over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, he found, you know, ways to try to disrupt that system. But, I mean, it was pretty, if we had two guys in the heat, obviously.
Right.
I mean, it only works if you had two guys in the heat. But then it became even more strategic later. Like, for instance.
So you guys didn't care what was being said because, like, I know there's.
It was working.
You son of a bitch.
and I'm not saying it wasn't unfair.
They were dominated because, I mean, I saw it. Everybody saw what was happening and were like, those motherfuckers are using team tactics. And if you have two in your heat, you're fucked.
You're pretty fucked if you had two of us.
A lot of us were on quote unquote teams, but we were not team members.
No, we were never.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think the Wave Rebel crew and the Tubes crew tried to get that.
Yeah.
But it didn't have the same kind of commitment. And I attribute that to the religion.
Oh, hell no. It was the religion. Stretching, stuff. Running.
Yeah. No,
and then the religious.
I just meant the commitment, like, to sacrifice. Like, I remember literally sometimes it got not as complicated, but like towards like a couple years into the tour, I remember only a few times it'd be like, nah, you know what? So-and-so is 17th right now in the ratings and there's only two contests left. We need to get so-and-so up to 9th or so for the contracts.
So crazy.
So if there's any way we can, let's do that. Chris, you're good already. You're in fifth for the year, you know, so blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I mean, and that wasn't at first, you know, but Bob became that when he learned the game himself, because so, obviously he learned that a lot of our contracts were incentives based, contest and photo. So if we did good in contests, we got more incentives too. Anyway.
So he knew everything that was going on.
He was a good strategist. Yeah. Very good. And, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but all the PSAA, like, judges and head honchos, they love to fucking chit chat with Bob. Like,
always saw Bob talking.
You always saw Bob talking with the judges. And he would just listen to what they are looking for. He would a lot of times like just listen to how they judge heats and then come back and tell us, you know, they're really interested in this. You know, I could see that, you know, blah, 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 blah. He was always there first thing in the morning for the conditions check and the call, you know, with the contest directors, just to see like what kind of conditions were on and which were passes, what variables were in play. He's a pretty smart dude in that regard.
That's crazy because now as we judge, we're very quiet and silent. Yeah. We can't make any noise. Like almost in regards to that, like we don't.
Right?
Want to
huh? Yeah. Yeah.
We don't want to let them know.
But here's the beautiful part about all of that: you guys were doing nothing wrong.
Right.
It wasn't written in the rules that you can do that.
None of us called any of that out either. Like
it's fucking bullshit. Amazing. We're like shit.
This is bullshit. It sucks for us.
Yeah.
I do have one story.
Totally.
Fuck.
Bring more.
The Bolsa Chica event.
I remember that one. Well, there were a couple, but I remember that.
I want to say I had three of the fucking Quiet Classic guys in the heat.
Wow. That's a bummer.
Yeah. I was like.
That was two of them were
going to
make it.
Yeah. For real.
You guys fucking fetched Kyle on me, and I was pissed.
Because
that little fucker was chasing me down smiling.
Yeah.
He knew exactly what he was doing. He pushed me all the way south outside of the contest area, and then he fucking bolted back.
He's the unending energizer bunny.
Dude, I took him all the way out. I mean, he took me all the way out and then fucking raced back. I'm like, you fucking asshole.
Oh, man. That guy.
But I got to experience that, and you guys didn't give a fuck.
Yeah, I guess not at first.
But
I mean,
it wasn't seen
I
as
kind
a
of
bad in, thing, I think, like you said, it was seen as a team effort and this is what we have to do in their minds. And everyone else it was so new to everybody that we were creating a reaction because there was none yet.
Yeah. Right? I think that I also want to say that there was a time towards the back end of the career when we did that less, you know, like I'm not for sure in the first 2 to 3 years it was game on, but then I think towards the back half it was more
we saw it
relaxed a little.
I think we saw it.
Yeah, I don't want to say gone, but relaxed.
Yeah,
you know,
I think all of you got covers too, didn't you?
I got a couple, I think three.
Yeah.
Which was just a pure matter of luck and happenstance. I happened to get along well with the photographers that we hung out with. Most notably in our day, it was Hank was my boy. Hank, Bielman, Dieball, Mike Balzer, Tom Boyle.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know. I just, for some reason, I got a lot of photos. I think in the early days, I got more photos than the other guys. And for some reason, that helped me in my later career when I had my own contract. But it was just luck. One of my best stories was I had a double pay. So
I don't think it's luck. I think what you were doing.
It's almost like setting the stage in a boy band. And the best one is the young one always. And they always end up doing something better than the other ones did. Yeah, I mean, isn't that how it is?
Well, you be the judge because I'll let you know. One day we were out at Pipe and it was perfect. I mean, 8 to 10. Offshore, sunny, gorgeous. Packed, packed, packed. I had been out there for, promise to God, like 3.5 hours. Zero waves so far. Oof. If you've been there, you know.
At that time, give us the pecking order. Who were the guys getting waves to where you were?
Okay, skip by all the surfers, like all the boys who, of course, were out and taking whatever they wanted. We're talking about bodyboarders, of course, Mike and Ben were getting their thing. Kainoa was getting any wave he wanted still. I was a Hawaiian dude, you know, local boy sorts, but I was pretty low on the pecking order.
Three and a half hours later.
Right, right. But this is good. This is good. This is a good one. And I remember it wasn't anyone like super important, but a really fucking epic wave started coming in, and the surfer guy paddling at the very, very last minute pulled out, and I fucking gulped, turned around, and you'll probably know which shot I'm talking about. And I took off on this pipe wave, and I just made a humongous, long, drawn-out bottom turn, and then I hit the shoulder by gums and did, like, a big flyaway air. And that one wave got me, like, four spreads, a poster, fucking three ads. You know what I'm saying?
The one wave.
And that was it. So
it was like 500 photographers.
I call that luck. Yeah, because everybody was out.
Right.
Everybody was out. And that was it. That was my one wave.
Fuck, you got it, though.
Yeah, so it was luck. Yeah. But it was good.
Fuck. Actually, we have that right here.
Yeah.
Clip. Yeah. Camera clip. All right. Ad magazine. Ad cover.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So graphic gone. Damn
it. Right. It was good times. I enjoyed bodyboarding. I hadn't been in the water for a long time. This digression's good, but we'll go for it.
All right. We're still coming back to the debacle.
Yeah, yeah.
So
how's the questions all good? Did that get you, Big Todd? Yeah. The team tactics. That was a good one.
Can you read that far?
No.
Oh, that's what he was saying. All right. So we left you at, that trip that you went to Tahiti by yourself, bring us back there.
Not yet.
Really?
Well, here's why. I figure we can wrap up. My little breeze through. So, because we talked about how I got into bodyboarding, then the early days of the contest, the team, the training regiments, the blah, 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 the rules, the fun stuff, the team tactics. At some point in time around 1994, I decided that I was going to graciously sort of bow out of full-time competition.
How many years were you into?
17 to 24. What is that?
7 years.
7 years, yeah. And
were those good 7 years?
Yeah, so out of the 7 years, my lowest ranking was 12th, which I was pretty stoked about. And it's the consistency thing, right?
Like, yeah.
Lowest ranking, 12th, highest ranking, third or one of those. Yeah. Third or second. I got second once. Yeah, I did get second once in the year. Nice. So anyway, and then I decided to go to school. I went to school, moved to California.
But you were still riding.
I was riding, but I become team manager now for Challenger. And I would come to the pipe event and like the US Open and stuff like that, the bigger events.
What were you doing?
So this was, I was a team manager for Challenger, and I was in charge after both Dave Kniff and JP Patterson, with, you know, kind of getting a little team together. And I focused on one guy in Cali and one guy in Hawaii. And I remember my first team riders that I hired were Cameron Nelson from down south and Kaui Kaui. A young Kaui from east side of Oahu.
How did you find these guys?
I'd known both of them. Like, Cameron, he was younger, but he was on the, he was doing contests and stuff. And same with Kaui. Kaui was really energetic, fun local boy from Sandy's. Well, he's from, you know, a little bit farther east, but he was like Sandy's Makapu. And I was looking for people of influence, and I wanted to get, look, Challenger had always been a certain image, and I kind of felt like, no, let's give one of the solid local boys, you know, some stuff. My team manager, days didn't last long, probably like 3 years, I think.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, and then, because I was just getting busier and busier in school. I graduated from college, did a couple master's degrees, did a PhD, started teaching.
Holy crap, all within what year span, or...
So like 94 to 99 was the first like stretch of school. And then I went on the road with my first band for like a year and a half, 2 years, like actually traveling and touring, playing music, like in a punk ska band.
Were you traveling, getting paid? Was that your job?
Yeah.
Holy shit. Yeah.
It was, anyone who's been on the road will know, yes, you're getting paid and it's yes, your job, but no, you're not making that much money. Okay? All those things are true. Okay.
But enough to sustain that.
Yeah. Dude, who you care? You're fucking living on the road. Yeah, so I came back and then I decided to go back to school. That's when I went to San Diego State for a master's degree. And then finally I transferred to UC Santa Barbara for a master's and PhD. After that, I got my first full-time job in the University of Hawaii system. So I moved back to Kauai, taught there full-time for 5 years. Then I reduced my contract to part-time, moved to Santa Monica because my daughters, let's just say they didn't like Hawaii life as much as they like California life.
Mm.
And so it's kind of a weird time for me. I was stoked because I had a new job, but my kids weren't really stoked because it's not that they didn't like it there. I mean, they loved Hawaii, but I mean, especially my oldest daughter, she was 17, young and ambitious. And then she had a younger sister and not really wanting to separate them at the time. I moved to California and I lived in Santa Monica. And it's actually a really good point because living in Santa Monica, so I could be nearer to my eldest daughter who was living in the Venice area. And then my youngest daughter went to school in Santa Monica. I got back in the ocean because when I started school, you know, I would be in the water here and there, but I would say I was on like a 10 to 12 year hiatus, you know, in terms of getting in there.
Yeah.
You know? And it's funny, when I moved to Santa Monica, I eventually got a teaching job, part-time teaching job at Santa Monica College.
Perfect.
But not right away. And what happened was I answered a fucking Craigslist ad for a surf instructor. And it was right down at Santa Monica Pier. And I don't know how, just the gods of the water, just before I knew it, I was just like, I was back, you know, surfing regular.
Yep.
That's the way it comes back, yeah. Too. You re-baptize yourself in salt.
Yeah. And, I mean, Jess will tell you now, like, I can't stop talking about going home and surfing. I mean, so the last, I would say the last 5 years of my life, I've been back in the water now. The last 5 years of my life, I've been back in the water. It's been very good for the soul, good for the dude. The fuck were you thinking being out of touch with the water for so long? You know, it was very good. So, and that's kind of wrapped up things to here. And we can digress later.
But did you, like, were you expecting that?
Not at all. I literally took the job because I needed work. Because I moved over. I quit my job in Hawaii, which was, in hindsight, so stupid. The good news is I got my job back. So I'm moving back to Hawaii and entering the University of Hawaii system again. Happy about that. But
can I just say something before we keep going?
Yeah.
You moved through a real fast point that I think all of us were kind of like, what did you just fucking say? You said really quickly that you have a master's and a PhD.
Give us all the master's and the PhDs you have.
So I've got a master's degree in religion, which seems obvious. So I got into school because I thought I wanted to not become a minister, but I thought I wanted to become a religious academic. I had heard on radio while I was in California as a bodyboarder doing the tours, I had heard a kind of broadcast because Bob would tune into these religious broadcasts. I'm in the fucking van, right? And I was really turned on by the way this one guy talked. It was like he was only like a preacher. He was more like a, I don't know, you got Bible questions, I'll answer them for you. And it was like kind of more intellectually minded. So I was all, something I was just like, you know, that's pretty interesting. And then eventually I was just like, maybe that. So I went to school for religion, got a bachelor's degree in religion, got a master's degree in religion, And the academic side, which is very rigorous, it was probably the hardest I've ever worked, even harder than my other degrees, which I'll talk about in a second. But it was funny is because at the end of all that education, you know what I had more of now? I had more unanswered questions about religion.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because a lot of things aren't fitting up because you know so much.
What do you think?
So I was young and naive, and like the story fit so well together. And I was all, yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, fucking yeah. Yeah. You know, like it was all good. And then, you know, when I started becoming an adult and started like having the tools for critical thinking, and it's not like I was even studying anything that was against religion. I was studying religion in an academic sense. And then, you know, digging into the history, the language, the culture, the crazy things people don't talk about, I became really disenchanted. Like, that's the only way to say it. I was like, wow, really? I see now what I never saw before. And again, it's maybe some people, it's still okay after that. For me, it wasn't. So in one of my best moves ever, I like this. I actually like this move. In one of my best moves ever, I now had a fairly prestigious master's degree from, a seminary that was geared more towards academics than preaching. And I was living in San Diego at the time. I remember calling San Diego State and going, hey, I called the philosophy department and I talked to the chair of the philosophy department, introduced myself, and I go, you know, I've got no formal training in philosophy. You know, I've got official degrees, you know, I've got all the prerequisites, you know, and I've taken a couple philosophy courses, but nothing gradual. I said, what would it take to get me just straight into the program? And he said, come down, we'll talk. So we had an interview. It's a really charming dude, smooth guy. I'll never forget him. He got me started on my philosophical career. His name is Steve Barboni. And anyway, after like an interview with him personally, he had me take a test. He called me back the next day. He's all, how about this? How about, in addition to the usual credits for a master's degree, you take 10 extra credits. I was like, fucking dope. So I did a master's degree there, and it was in philosophy. So my idea was, I knew where I needed to go because my unanswered questions in religion all led to larger philosophical questions. So I went into philosophy, did a master's degree there.
But I'm really impressed on the part where you're like, you picked up the phone and you called.
Yeah, that's my Kawhi style. I was like,
most people would probably look through a catalog and see the route that they need to take and then start, you know, that program. But you called them straight up, said, what do I need to do?
Well, here's why I was tired. And I knew the academic game already. Remember, I'd already been through a BA and an MA. And I was like, fuck that, dude. I don't want to fucking have to minor in fucking philosophy. And then, you know, fuck that. Like, I knew I was pretty smart, you know, at least smart enough to get into a, you know, San Diego State program, maybe a little extra. It was one of the best things I ever did because my work there got me into UC Santa Barbara, which was probably one of the best times of my life, man.
In what regards?
Fucking loved it, dude.
what was it?
Loved it. So I was super stoked because anyone who's done grad school know, and I know that a couple of people from our past have gone into academia. Like, I'm pretty sure Tim Ross has a couple degrees or something. But anyway, the point is that when you get into a graduate program, at least in the UC system, it's a big deal. It's like I got grants. So rather than paying to go to school, like, I was being paid to go to school. So I had my housing taken care of. I was getting paid to do well in the program.
Did you know that at that time?
Oh, yeah. Like, it's very competitive.
And do they hold you accountable?
Yeah.
So if you fuck up one semester, you're done? Or one?
It wasn't one semester. You came up for review. Okay. You know? But I wasn't about that. I was stoked to be in. And so I gobbled it up. And I did really good. I met some of my best friends there, blah, blah, blah. I learned a lot. I think I really became the person that I wanted to be from the training that I got through all my education, but mostly UC Santa Barbara. Yeah. On paper, my area of specialization is ancient Greek philosophy. But in practice, as most teachers will know, I teach mostly introduction to philosophy. logic ethics classes.
Oh my goodness.
And I love it. Huh?
Christopher Socrates.
Yeah, but and I love it. And so I still do that. I just wrapped up the fall semester. We've been online.
Epic.
And, yeah.
That's frightening, right? Because he's like master in religion and psychology. Should we like not?
Well, not psychology, philosophy.
Philosophy. Yeah.
Okay, so we should watch out for the questions he asks.
So that kind of caps the whole like how I got into things and how I ended things. So now, if we want to digress back to other things or new questions, we can. Are you sure we're good on time?
Yeah. Yeah, we got plenty of time.
That's amazing.
We got 32 hours.
Bodyboarding life, and then you have this entire other envelopment or bubble.
Yeah.
That is a dream for someone's entire life.
Yeah, I'm pretty stoked.
So
I'm very happy these days.
On top of each other, and you're still going.
I consider myself to be very lucky.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, congrats on everything.
Dude.
Are you super stoked to go back?
I'm really happy, man. My time in Long Beach, has been interesting. My girlfriend Jess and I have only been here a year, and we got to this apartment that we're in January of 2020, literally.
Whoa.
And then COVID and all this. So it's been an interesting year, and we were only here because we were interested in a business opportunity in legal cannabis, but that dried up. So, you know what? The back half of my life, I'm interested now in just going home and savoring the creature comforts of life.
Trunks and flippers.
Trunks and flippers. Yeah, I'm going to become the Pakala's uncle. That's what I want to be.
Right.
You all know the uncles, right?
Oh,
and
your
home breaks when you're the guys growing up. And you're like, you're happy to see that guy out there because you're like, yeah, I know that guy. That's Uncle So-and-so.
Yeah.
But then you're also like, fuck, Uncle gets a lot of waves, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, where are we at? So
you want to go back to the Chopu thing?
Yeah. Okay, but so, you know what? Let's save that for the very end.
Okay, good. That takes 15 minutes, just so you know.
Okay, well, this will take as long as it needs to take.
Yeah.
I call this five on the fly.
Oh.
It's five questions I ask everybody.
Perfect.
Just so we have something to compare.
Okay.
So the first one, your favorite bodyboarder and why?
Can I give two? One drop knee, one prone.
That's
a good distinction.
Yeah, there's really no rules in this stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with Mike for prone rider for reasons expressed earlier. I think just the romanticizing of the old days and those early images. And also, I'm kind of more of a style slut than a maneuver guy. You know, like, maneuvers really impress me. Don't get me wrong. Like, I was talking to you off camera before, like, you know, the whole progressive end of bodyboarding, I think about like jazz music to me. Like, I'm very impressed with the technicality and the creativity of jazz, but I can't fucking stand listening to it. Like, it's not my thing at all.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. I can't do jazz. Like, I couldn't do jazz if I tried. Right. And I appreciate the guys that can, but I'm not into it. And, you know, for as progressive as Mike wants to think he is, I think Mike's best surfing was in meat and potatoes, you know, rolls, cutties, spins, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
And barrel riding. And I really gravitated to that in my own, like, riding, trying to make it just smooth and, you know, draw clean lines. And then since I wanted to, it's because I would say that competitively I excelled in prone. But drop knee was always my passion and fun. You know this too, because you're a drop knee and a prone guy too. And you both know that back in the day, even if you loved drop knee, you were running a fucking risk if you were going to drop knee in a heat.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
It
was almost suicide.
Yeah.
Now, photos and free surf, bro, I would be almost 90% drop knee. And maybe that was my surfing background or whatever. I just enjoyed the cuts, the lines, the rah, rah, rah. It was fun.
Yeah, if you were a roach, you didn't want to do it.
Right. Oh, yeah. Roach was. So that roach would definitely be.
But that's how, but if you're known as a drop knee, you better show up in the contest and drop knee at least one wave.
Yeah, he stuck to his guns. And I would say that my favorite bodyboarder, to answer your question, on the drop knee side when I was young and through the thing was Roach. Why? Stylish, aggressive. Goofy foot like me. I just liked it. Kainoa McGee also. Kainoa McGee's style was a little more powerful But I liked the finesse of the way Roach moved. It was more in my vein.
Non-rail yeah. grabbers, nobody grabbing rails.
Yeah, yeah.
Biggest wave.
What was the biggest wave I surfed? Probably pipe. I mean, I'm not a big wave guy. I got no problem saying that, okay? All you guys out there are chargers. Right on, dude. Like, I would say pipe 10 feet. Like, beyond that. And by the way, not even beyond that. Anywhere from 6 feet up, I'm holding ass.
Yeah.
Okay, right? Don't worry about it. I'm not ashamed to say that. But I've taken off on some 10-footers, you know, but I'm definitely not a size king. No.
Okay. You haven't answered it.
Oh, what was it?
My biggest
wave? Yeah. It was at pipe, probably 10 feet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you did 12. Answer it.
Yeah, I did. You're just still stoned. Right? Meanwhile, I'm cringing because I want to take another bongy and you're coming into focus right now. Yeah.
Go ahead. Go take a break.
No. Let's do this.
We have plenty of time. Go for it.
Well, it's 2:05. We're okay.
Yeah, I'll be right back. Yeah, take a break. There you go. I'm going to grab some water.
Headphones.
Oh, son of a.
Oh, no.
Here.
Oh, we're good. They're good plugs.
Did I turn it off, though?
No. Holy shit. Everybody.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we lost everybody on the internet.
No, I see you. You're right here.
The internet disrupted.
Yeah, I'm right here.
Nobody can get on their Venmo anymore.